Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 23. Thanks for joining me. As always, before we get started, I want to thank you for your support. As some of you may know, podcast advertising is in a bit of a slump right now. If I was relying purely on advertising to keep the show going, I would be in pretty dire straits at the moment. But fortunately, I have all of you to back me up, so the future of the Age of Napoleon is quite secure, even if advertising collapses entirely. So when I say the show would not be possible without you guys, I mean that quite literally. Anyway, on with the program. I'd like to start with a little material that was cut from the last episode. In case you're listening to these out of sequence, this dispatch will be released just after episode 113, Victory or Death, in which we covered the formation of the Spanish juntas, the outbreak of war in Spain, and the shocking French defeat at the Battle of Bailén. As you may have noticed, that episode was absolutely overstuffed. I had to gloss over or even cut out a lot of content, and it still wound up being one of the longest episodes ever. You might recall that I read a declaration from one of the juntas, calling for volunteers for the army and financial contributions from the wealthy. This is where I got the title for the episode, Victory or Death. That was just the juiciest of several similar pronouncements from various juntas that I came across during my research, calling for volunteers, asserting their political authority, declaring themselves in rebellion against King Joseph, declaring war on France, or all of the above. There was a surprising thread that jumped out at me in several of these documents. Enlisting their enemies and grievances, many of them mention a person who no longer played any role in Spanish politics, our old friend Manuel Godoy. For example, the proclamation of the Junta of Orihuela in southeastern Spain starts, quote, "Valiant Spaniards, the fatherland's independence, its institutions, the sacred religion we profess, and the preservation of our king, our lives, and our property, call us imperiously to arms. A traitor to the country has placed before us the harsh choice of being subjugated by a perfidious ally or of taking up arms in defense of our independence and rights. What Spaniard can doubt the side he should take? None, surely." End quote. The way the proclamation was phrased, you would almost think this was, in part, a rebellion against Godoy. And in a certain sense, it was. During this period, in many cities and towns across Spain, popular unrest was directed against officials who had been appointed by the sausage maker. In many cases, one of the first priorities of these new juntas was to remove those officials and replace them with solid patriots. I think it goes to show you how closely Godoy was identified with the French. With the benefit of hindsight, we know the relationship between the sausage maker and Napoleon was far more complicated than that. But given what the Spanish public knew at the time, it was probably inevitable that he came to be seen as nothing but a French stooge. And so, opposition to the French and opposition to Godoy were almost synonymous. Of course, by the time these proclamations were written, Godoy had been out of power for months and had actually fled the country, never to return. The sausage maker really did a number on Spain. Even after he was gone and no longer posed any threat to the public, the memory of his misrule helped inspire people to take up arms. It is an interesting anecdote, but not really relevant to the future of our story. We had a lot of ground to cover last episode, and we already said our goodbyes to Godoy in episode 112, so I decided to leave it out. Now, on to your questions. First, Britt Cleaver asked, "I have a question about Antoine Christophe Salicetti and the French patronage system in general. I always liked hearing about Salicetti, and it seems he did a huge amount to help Napoleon politically, and back before anyone knew just how far Napoleon would rise. I always wonder, though, what did Salicetti himself actually get out of that partnership? How did the patronage system work? Was Salicetti's goal simply to promote a person with similar ideologies, or was there a more formal arrangement to political patronage?" First off, I'm glad at least one of you enjoyed hearing about Salicetti. I always enjoyed writing about him. He was one of those characters whose name I knew before starting the show, but wound up surprising me a bit. I found him a lot more interesting than I'd anticipated. Anyway, to get to your question, in theory, the various Republican governments of the 1790s all maintained legal separation between the military and civilian politics. The revolutionaries were students of history, in particular the history of classical Rome. They viewed the fall of the Roman Republic as an important cautionary tale. Many believed the power of the Roman army and the connections between the military leadership and the Roman political process were to blame. Every regime of the First French Republic sought to avoid the fate of Rome by delineating clear separations of powers between the military and the government in the constitution, legislation, and military regulations. Of course, as Mao Zedong so memorably put it, political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. That's particularly true when the authority and legitimacy of the state are shaky, as they were during the French Revolution. Violence, or the threat of violence, could act as the ultimate political trump card. Not only that, the military was one of the only institutions in the country that was well-organized, disciplined, and widely seen as legitimate. On top of all that, as we discussed in past episodes, the fear of counter-revolutionaries within the military led to the vetting of officers for ideological reliability and overt political indoctrination of the troops. Under these conditions, it was probably inevitable that the line between the military and politics would become blurred, no matter how boldly the legislators drew that line. Patron-client relationships, like the one between Napoleon and Salicetti, were one of the easiest ways for politicians and generals to circumvent the laws that were meant to keep them separate, so they could form mutually beneficial relationships. As you mentioned in your question, it's pretty clear what Napoleon got out of this partnership, but what about Salicetti? In our early episodes, we saw several occasions in which the army played a pivotal role in politics. Think of all the coups and attempted coups, or the times in which the government was threatened by popular unrest. In the last dispatch, we talked about the time Napoleon sent some intelligence back to his political allies in Paris, which enabled them to neutralize General Charles Pichegru, who had become one of the government's most dangerous domestic opponents. The army was an important source of power. By the later years of the revolution, perhaps the most important source of power in the whole country. The unofficial system of patronage between politicians and generals allowed France's civilian leaders to build influence within the institution. It's also important to keep in mind that for much of their relationship, Salicetti was actually supposed to be providing direct oversight over Napoleon, in his capacity as representative on mission for the Army of Italy. As you might remember from our episodes on the First Italian Campaign, that oversight often really meant Napoleon and Salicetti collaborating to advance their own interests, and those of the army, even if it meant acting against the interests of the central government, which Salicetti was supposedly there to represent. You see the same dynamic in the headquarters of many other French armies in this period. It was an inherent flaw in the system of representatives on mission. There were obvious places where the interests of the generals and the representatives aligned, and Paris was a long way from the front, both literally and in the era before the invention of the telegraph, figuratively too. In these circumstances, I think it was quite natural for the representatives and the generals to collaborate, even if on paper their relationship was supposed to be somewhat adversarial. This dynamic is certainly not unique to the late 18th century or to revolutionary France. Even today, it is certainly not unheard of for government regulators to get too cozy with the people they are supposedly regulating. Obviously, there was a lot of loot to be had. Many French generals helped themselves to some of the spoils of war, rather than sending them all back to the capital as they were supposed to. Some even stole directly from the central government, usually by inflating the numbers of men under their command, then pocketing the extra pay and selling off any surplus equipment and rations. Giving the local representatives on mission a cut was a lot easier than trying to hide this type of activity, And so, in many cases, a representative and the general he was supposed to be monitoring became partners in crime, and thus had an obvious incentive to watch each other's backs. As you may remember, Napoleon himself was not big on this type of personal corruption. He was certainly not above using his position for personal gain. He obtained a huge fortune during his time in Italy on a relatively modest general salary, and used his position to advance his political career. But he did steer clear of the more obvious and flagrant forms of corruption. After all, he was playing a much longer and grander game than most Republican generals. Where he was going, a reputation for corruption could be a real hindrance. And besides, he really did believe in public service, in his own way. However, as you might recall from our episodes on the First Italian Campaign, he did often ask Salicetti to look the other way on violations of the law and military regulations. Bonaparte might not have been quite as fond of stealing as many other Republican generals, but he habitually disobeyed Paris when he felt it was in the army's interest, using outside funds to procure uniforms and equipment, and distributing loot to the men as a reward for good service. Representatives on mission weren't literally getting a cut from this type of rule-breaking, but they did have an incentive to look the other way on anything that might strengthen the army they monitored, because they would get a share of the glory of victory. It does seem a bit silly in hindsight. I've read a lot about the campaigns of the Wars of the Revolution, and I don't think I've ever encountered an historian talking about civilian government oversight as a decisive factor in achieving victory. But unfairly or not, if an army won battles and conquered territory, it reflected well on the representatives on mission at the headquarters. Just like our politicians today, revolutionary leaders loved to wrap themselves in the flag and bask in military glory, which had been won by the efforts of others. So to sum up, a patron-client relationship with a general offered many benefits to a revolutionary politician. They could extend their influence into one of the most powerful institutions in France, and in fact, this was the only practical legal avenue to do so. If they got themselves assigned to be representative on mission to an army led by a friendly general, there were further opportunities for wealth and prestige. Next, Daniel Goldstein asked, "Currently in the narrative, the tension between France and Spain is at a fever pitch. Right between the two, you find Little Andorra, which has been independent since the 13th century. What is their diplomatic position? Are they aligned with France? Neutral? Do they figure at all into the considerations of Napoleon or the Spanish?" This is a good question. I had actually never considered this. For those of you who might be unaware, Andorra is a tiny landlocked sovereign country in the Pyrenees Mountains, directly between France and Spain. If you trace the Franco-Spanish border from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic, it's about a quarter of the way up that line. When I say tiny, I mean tiny. Andorra is about 180 square miles, only a little over one-tenth the size of Rhode Island, the smallest American state. Or for our British listeners, it is about 81% the size of the Isle of Man. Today, its population is a little over 80,000, and historically it was even smaller and almost entirely rural. Andorra has a somewhat unusual political setup, with two heads of state, the Bishop of Urgell, which is in Spanish Catalonia, and the French president. This is a very old arrangement. Historically, it was the Bishop of Urgell and the King of France. This somewhat strange situation is a reflection of geography. High in the Pyrenees, Andorra is an out-of-the-way, inaccessible place. It has no great concentration of resources and no major population centers. By putting itself under the partial sovereignty of both of its powerful neighbors, Andorra was able to preserve its independence from both. Throughout history, basically everyone, on all sides of the border, have been content with this arrangement. The geography meant Andorra was of little use to France or Spain, and with the two powers having roughly equal influence over the little country, there was no reason to change things. There does not seem to be very much written in English about the effects of the Peninsular War on Andorra. Most of my books on the topic don't even mention it. Here's what I could glean. During the Revolution, the Andorrans continued to send their annual tribute to Paris, which by this point in history was more of a symbolic gesture, meant to represent their recognition of the ruler of France as one of their co-sovereigns. The revolutionaries refused to accept this payment. After all, this was an ancient feudal due, very much not their style. The other co-sovereign, the Bishop of Urgell, did continue to accept his annual tribute. So, legally speaking, the bishop became the sole sovereign over the country, although it seems this had no practical impact and was never codified in any law or treaty. During the War of the First Coalition, France invaded Spain, and it seems that during these operations, French troops crossed into Andorran territory. A delegation of Andorrans approached the local French general to remind him of their country's neutrality, and apparently he listened, and pulled his troops out of the small corner of Andorran territory they had occupied. After Napoleon's coronation, the Andorrans petitioned the new emperor to restore the old arrangement, accept their tribute, and the title of co-sovereign. Napoleon agreed, and in 1806, the legal limbo ended. Andorra once again had two sovereigns. However, this only lasted 6 years. We are skipping ahead, but in 1812, Napoleon would begin annexing Catalonia into France proper. Andorra has always been culturally and linguistically tied to Catalonia, and so it was included in these plans. Napoleon was not a fan of these types of holdovers from medieval times. He was, by nature, a modernizer and a centralizer. This little principality with its unusual political structure did not really fit with his vision, and so it was absorbed into one of the new French Catalan departments, becoming just another series of sparsely populated mountain valleys, governed from the nearby town of Puigcerdà. Legally, Andorra ceased to exist, but as we discussed, this was an out-of-the-way place, and at this time in history, very poor. It seems the annexation didn't change everyday life in Andorra. By 1814, France had totally lost control of all of its Iberian territories. Napoleon legally recognized a restored Andorra, and the country has been independent ever since. Next, Zach Spawn asked, I've always wondered what became of the kids who bullied Napoleon when he was at the military academy. Presumably, some of them would have been officers during the consulate or empire. We all know that Napoleon tended to respond harshly to any personal slight, and it seems that these experiences hurt him when he was at his most vulnerable. Are there any accounts of Napoleon interacting with any of his bullies as adults, or of him dealing out any kind of retribution? Did any of the kids that picked on Napoleon ever own up to it as adults and express regrets? Throughout his life, Napoleon spoke fondly of his time at Brienne. When you go back and look at his correspondence from that time, and at the harshness of the curriculum and daily life at the school, it seems unbelievable, but Bonaparte credited Brienne with making him the man he became. It is possible that he felt differently in private. He was keenly aware of public perceptions, and it is a bit unbecoming for a grown man, especially a famous conqueror and statesman, to complain about middle school bullying. And let's be blunt here, Napoleon was a sensitive, idealistic youth who grew into a hard, cynical man. Perhaps he actually credited the bullying he experienced for toughening him up. So I don't know of any cases of Napoleon seeking revenge on his bullies, or even expressing bitterness towards them. If he did harbor any negative feelings from those days into adulthood, he never expressed them that I know of. You would think that as a lifelong military leader, he would have had constant contact with his former tormentors as he rose through the ranks, but thinking about the numbers, that might not actually have been the case. First of all, remember, Brienne was not the only military academy in France. It was just one of a large network of similar schools. only the best cadets were actually chosen to continue their military education and become officers. The bottom 50% of every class was absolved of their obligations to the French state and entered civilian life. Let's be honest here, your average bully is usually not at the top of his class. I would guess that a lot of Napoleon's most hated antagonizers never entered the army. There was also a portion of the cadets who were selected for the navy, not the army, and thus would not have had much professional contact with Bonaparte. Then you add to that the high casualties among junior officers during the War of the First Coalition, the large number of aristocratic officers who defected or emigrated during the Revolution, and the general high mortality rates during this period, and I think there's actually a fairly good chance Napoleon never encountered any of his bullies ever again after leaving Brienne. There is one notable exception, an officer named Louis-Edmond Antoine Le Picard de Philippot. This is the only one of Napoleon's bullies who usually gets named in accounts of his childhood. They are often described as enemies or rivals, but Philippot was 2 years older, and from a much more established and eminent noble family, so I would guess he was the aggressor. Then again, some accounts say Napoleon was the one who started it, supposedly being jealous of Philippot's academic excellence. Whatever the case, everyone seems to agree the two boys hated each other. As you might expect of a member of the upper nobility, in the 1790s, Philippot sided with the counter-revolution. He actually served under the Duke of Enghien before he was infamously murdered by Napoleon. Philippot also took part in various royalist intrigues within France, to varying degrees of success. In 1798, Philippot took on an important and very ambitious mission to break the colorful Royal Navy captain Sidney Smith out of prison in Paris. Philippot developed a bold and probably overcomplicated plan to achieve this, but it fell apart almost immediately. So he took the path of least resistance, and simply paid a large bribe to obtain a false order of release. By the time the French authorities realized what was happening, Smith and Philippot were on their way to London. They must have made a good team, because they would stay together for their next assignment. They were to sail for the Middle East, to help the Ottoman Empire fight off a French invasion, led by General Napoleon Bonaparte. By the time Smith and Philippot arrived in the Eastern Mediterranean, Bonaparte and the Army of the Orient had embarked on their offensive into the Levant, and were closing in on the fortified city of Acre. As you might remember from way back in episode 47, Smith and Philippot helped lead the defense of the city. Their ships intercepted and captured the French siege artillery, leaving Napoleon with only his lighter field guns to bombard the fortifications. The British squadron also kept the defenders fed and supplied, and ferried in reinforcements. Inside the city, Smith and Philippot helped train and organize the garrison, built improvised supplementary fortifications, and directed counter-battery fire against the French artillery. Napoleon stubbornly maintained the siege for weeks, but under these conditions, it was almost impossible for the French to actually take Acre. Finally, after several failed assaults, Napoleon had no choice but to abandon the siege and march back to Egypt. The successful defense of Acre proved to be one of the turning points of the campaign. Although it would be years before the Army of the Orient finally surrendered, the French would never regain the initiative in this theater of the war. According to some sources, up until the end of his life, Napoleon blamed Philippot, and to a lesser extent, Smith, for foiling his dreams of an empire in the East. As you probably remember from our episodes on the expedition, it had been a long shot from the very beginning, so maybe that speaks to some lingering bitterness from the schoolyard at Brienne. Philippot did not savor his victory. He died the day before the last Republican troops left the siege lines around Acre, of an unknown illness, possibly bubonic plague. He was just 32 years old. So Bonaparte never got the chance to exact revenge on the man who was, by all accounts, his worst schoolyard bully. Finally, you might recall that last episode, listener Thurgrave asked about Napoleon's opinion of composer Ludwig von Beethoven. I responded, I had been wondering about this myself for quite some time, but had never been able to find an answer. I asked if any of you might be able to shed light on this. We didn't get a full answer to this question, but we did get some intriguing leads. Listener Naomi Zhu left an interesting comment about Beethoven's relationship with another prominent Napoleonic character. Quote, there's a lot of interesting info about Napoleon and his missed connections with Beethoven in Jan Swafford's Beethoven biography. Apparently, Beethoven and Bernadotte became friends when Bernadotte was in Vienna in 1798, and the composer loved hearing Bernadotte's war stories. Plus, stuff about how various people tried to bring Beethoven to Paris over the years, but it never quite worked out. End quote. Another listener, Maxwell Neely Cohen, provided some information about the connections between Beethoven and a different member of the Bonaparte family, and to one of Napoleon's close collaborators. Quote, while I haven't found anything yet, still looking, directly on Napoleon's view of Beethoven, I can tell you that his brother Jerome Bonaparte personally invited Beethoven to be his Kapellmeister in 1808, while Jerome was King of Westphalia. Beethoven accepted the offer, but only to leverage a better deal to stay in Vienna, so there is at least one direct connection to the Bonaparte family. Another connection occurs early in both of their careers. In 1797, Salicetti and Napoleon decreed, quote, to make certain, by reliable means, of such monuments of science and art as may be found in the cities conquered by the armies, and have them sent to France, end quote. French violinist and composer Rodolf Kreutzer was embedded with the Army of Italy as their traveling musicologist and copied hundreds of Italian manuscripts to be brought back to France. It is during this time that Kreutzer became friends with Beethoven, so much so that Beethoven dedicated his Violin Sonata No. 9 to him. End quote. That's all for now. I'll be back to you soon with more from the main narrative. We'll close out with Beethoven's Violin Sonata No. 9, dedicated to Kreutzer. As always, thanks for listening.